Pennsylvania, broadcast presidential election returns for the very first time in history.
It is now apparent that the Republican ticket of Harding and Coolidge is running well ahead of Thompson Roosevelt. At the present time, Harding has collected more than 16 million votes against some 9 million for the Democrats. We'll give you the state vote in just a moment. But first, we'd like to ask you to let us know if this broadcast is reaching you. Please drop us a card, address station KDKA, Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Now we get to some of the serious things. Now, my town of Moorhead, Kentucky, has gotten some national TV news coverage recently because one of our local holier-than-thous has promoted the wearing of T-shirts with the Ten Commandments on them. Well, someone should tell the Southern Baptists that one of those commandments is thou shalt not steal, because in 1970, the Southern Baptists sent radio stations a record of public service announcements commemorating the 50th anniversary of broadcasting. In that album, or in that transcription, they played the KDKA recording stolen directly off the Jack Benny album.
It began in a garage near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the first regularly scheduled radio program. Returns of the Harding-Cox presidential election.
It is now apparent that the Republican ticket of Harding and Coolidge is running well ahead of Cox and Roosevelt. At the present time, Harding has collected more than 16 million votes against some 9 million for the Democrats.
The Radio and Television Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention salutes the broadcasting industry for half a century of public service to the nation and this community.
Now, if you can't trust the media evangelists, who can you trust? Richard Nixon, someone said here. Now, others have used... let me make a statement now. And I put it in my listing there at the last minute. I found out the name of the original KDK announcer was Leo Rosenberg. Again, in the second version of the acknowledgments, there is an L.R. or L.H. Rosenberg listed. He is not there in the list when the album was reissued. He became an executive of one of the advertising agencies, I believe Lord and Thomas. Now, this could be Rosenberg's voice. But because of the sound effects, that is the clue that we know that the thing has been phonied up. They filtered it, and there's a little distortion in here in this playback, but if you listen to the original album, the high frequencies are there and are silky smooth if you just go beyond the equalization and the filtering. Now, we can give you some examples here of some other things just very quickly. Let's go ahead to some other things. Let me just say some of the recordings which I have here, if we had more time, we could explain them. The Lowell Thomas recording, where he welcomes Lindbergh home. Well, I think that's coming up next.
It all began on November 2nd, 1920. On that date,
Well, that's something else. Lowell Thomas says he has arrived, Lindbergh has arrived. NBC, on their 50th anniversary program, proclaimed that Lowell Thomas had welcomed Lindbergh home on NBC. The problem was Lowell Thomas didn't make his radio debut until 1930, 3 years later, and that when he made his radio debut, it was on CBS. But CBS doesn't get off that easily, because in their 50th anniversary program the following year, they played a recording of Robert Trout doing the 1932 election returns. Well, that really was Robert Trout's voice. But Robert Trout came in to the studio to do a favor to Morrow and Friendly. We assumed that that was the reason why. And recreated the 32 election returns, being very careful not to mention CBS because he was working for NBC in 1950. Ted Husing does a ball game announcement that may be what's on here now.
Thank you, Ben.
Nope, that's John Chancellor and Ben Grauer. He does a baseball game with Babe Ruth hitting a home run.
One of the most suspenseful days in broadcasting's 50-year history was in 1927, when all America listened for news of the young flyer skimming low over the Atlantic. And then...
This is Lowell Thomas in New York. He made it. Charles A. Lindbergh landed at Le Bourget Airport, Paris.
Last year, millions of Americans again held their breath until they heard...
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The future? You'll hear it right here. It's broadcasting's golden anniversary, and the best is yet to come.
So I was putting that thing in. That was done by the National Association of Broadcasters for the 50th anniversary. I'm looking for my sheet here of what is on the tape. Okay, from that same montage about Lindbergh's arrival, here is...
This is WJZ, New York. George Hicks reporting. As Saturday dawned over the vast Atlantic, the Lindbergh plane is unreported since passing Newfoundland early last night.
Now that's nifty, except that George Hicks didn't make his radio debut until over a year later in September 1928, and that was at WRC in Washington, D.C., not WJZ Newark. And the sound you hear behind Hicks was a sound effects record of an airplane which was held under the entire montage until Lowell Thomas spoke. Now on the second side of that NAB anniversary spot disc are the inserts used, and you can hear the sound of the plane fading out under Thomas's first words, indicating that that's where they got the recording from, off of I Can Hear It Now. Now those are what I classify as medium quality recordings. Now some of the inserts are of high quality. Now here's that Ted Husing ball game that I was indicating before.
Here he is in the motion, there's the windup. Here's the pitch, it's a slow curve low, and the Babe swings. It's a long one going out toward right center. Stengel's backing up against the wall. He can't get it. It's in there. Another home run for the Bambino. So the Babe hits his second homer today.
But now, if you heard this on this album, wouldn't you believe it? You can't hear the sound quality.
A man who seemed to remember practically everything about everybody was Ted Husing, regarded by many as the greatest of all sportscasters. Sports were an important element of radio from the earliest days on, and Husing was there to report them all. Here he is announcing a very early but unidentified baseball game.
Wind up. Here's a pitch, it's a slow curve low, and a Babe swings. It's a long one.
Now also, did you hear that music that was on during the first words? That indicates that this guy that put the album out, this Radio Reruns, which is Metacom from 1974, he didn't get it off of I Can Hear It Now. He got it off of somebody's television or motion picture or radio documentary about baseball, and that was just some other music that was in the background. So once these things get generations and generations and generations away from the original, you can't tell where it is from, and you don't know, indeed, that the thing is a phony. That's what the real problem is, not that you can look at Volume 3 of I Can Hear It Now and say, okay, well, we shouldn't use this. But because of the problem, what about the people who have taken it off and it's dubbed and dubbed and dubbed? One of the most serious ones is the Al Smith recording. Al Smith, my friends of the radio audience, it's an actor. Yet both NBC and, excuse me, Les, the National Archives, Les has apologized for it, used that recording of an actor portraying Al Smith to say maybe that's why he lost the election, because that's the way he sounded on radio. And, that's just like Bob Vinson saying that he can tell the personality of people from listening to their voices. And that's how he could tell what the personality of William McKinley was like. Look that up. It's in the 1940 article in the New Yorker magazine about Bob Vinson. He actually made that statement. Again, because of the fact that we are going to get kicked out of here, I can't play this whole tape. We have some things of Graham McNamee. Maybe we can go through it tonight after the Volume 4 of I Can Hear It Now. But Murrow continued to make many other recordings of documentary material. Of course, he continued in broadcasting, both in radio and in television, and some of his work was included on phonograph records. Not all of them were done especially for phonograph records like this. Let me make it clear. Schwann is not correct when they label these things pre-war broadcasts. These I Can Hear It Now recordings were done specifically for phonograph records only. Most of the other things are only incidentally put on phonograph records. And George Henderson is going to speak to now some of these later recordings. As he mentions an album, I'll try to show it, hold it up, okay? But move the mic closer.
There are many Murrow recordings, maybe divided into two groups. First, what might be called the original recordings, recordings with original Murrow narration. And secondly, the audio reproduction of TV programs or soundtracks of motion pictures. In the first group, we have what some has called Volume 4 of, I can hear it now, the Winston Churchill recording. Probably the second best known of the I Can Hear It Now series. Appearing in 1955, the Churchill album was the first attempt to deal with a single personality. It was an authorized recording. I think it pleased Mr. Murrow a great deal that the great British statesman was satisfied with it. He makes this point very clearly in an interview, a very rare personal interview, which was broadcast on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation toward the end of his broadcasting career. Murrow and Friendly make it very clear that on the album jacket that all the quotations and speeches except those by Roosevelt, Eisenhower, and Chamberlain were spoken in Sir Winston's own voice. Two of the famous Churchill quotations are in the recording. Not originally spoken, but used by Churchill in later speeches. These were the blood, toil, tears, and sweat, and never did so many owe so much to so few. Both of these were delivered, but both of these excerpts came from addresses in the British House of Commons, but he delivered them, he used the same phrases again in later speeches, and these are in the Murrow album. The second album doesn't quite fit into our grouping, but for more of a, for want of a more specialized classification, I think we should leave it there. This is the This I Believe recording. Issued in 1953, about halfway through the extraordinary success of the radio series. It contains the philosophies of 10 living Americans and 10 immortals. It's still a pretty powerful piece of work when we listen to some of the recordings of the ten living Americans: Bernard Brooke, Helen Hayes, Helen Keller, Will Durant, and Carl Sandburg. The ten immortals included Socrates, Queen Victoria, FDR, Marie Curie, and so on. However, the commentaries were spoken by persons intimately connected with the familiar with the lives of these people, or in a few cases even by members of the family. The philosophies had been written by biographers or others who were considered the experts on the people, but in the case of Roosevelt, his son spoke the commentary. Eve Currie read the philosophy for her mother, and Will Rogers for father. We come now to the second group of Murrow recordings, those recorded from TV shows or from the soundtracks of motion pictures. The first two of these were actually part of the I Can Hear It Now series. The first, an interview with David Ben-Gurion. The second, an interview with Gamal Abdel Nasser. Both of these albums formed part of a special See It Now documentary on Egypt and Israel shown on CBS television in March 1946. Now we come to the lady from Philadelphia, Marian Anderson. This is a recorded document of Marian Anderson's mission to Asia in the fall of 1957, and is the soundtrack from See It Now program of December 1957.
It's not on Columbian, RCA Victor.
It doesn't say CBS See It Now anywhere, does it?
No, it says CBS See It Now, courtesy of CBS Television. Direct seal.
Satchmo the Great contains the music and extracts from the soundtrack of the film Satchmo the Great, released to United Artists. again produced by Murrow and Friendly. Some of the material was shown on the See It Now program.
In color or black and white? In color, okay. This is the interim version then. This is the JCL version.
The final two recordings don't really fall into either category. These were records included in a travel kit containing slides and other material. I have not seen the series, and if any of you have it or know of its existence, I would very much like to see it. It was called the Panorama Color Slide Travel Program. Mr. Murrow did the records on England and in Japan.
They come in a book. It's about 9 inches tall, about 7.5 deep. There's a 7-inch Columbia pressing and two rectangular,
two rectangular slides of about 7 inches or 8 inches by 4 inches and two rows of transparencies that are about an inch square and two full rows of these. There's a whole set of them, about 15 or so. Arthur Godfrey narrated a few of them, and I let a whole set of them slip through my fingers because I didn't look to see who narrated them. But you might find them in bookstores.
They probably were released in the late 1950s and were on sale apparently until about 1963. On our list, we have as well three recordings we might call tribute recordings, or the two volumes of Edward R. Murrow, or Reporter Remembers, and then this is Edward R. Murrow, which was the original, which was originally broadcast on CBS Radio 3 or 4 days after his death in 1965, narrated by Robert Trout. We find more and more Murrow material showing up in other recordings. For instance, An Ear to the Sounds of Our History, narrated by Eric Severite. We have four of his best-known excerpts from four of his best-known works.
Sorry, I didn't put that on the list. I hadn't realized that.
I didn't bring it.
And a Radiola release on the Nazi concentration camps. It contains the famous Buchenwald broadcast. The real question remaining is, why did we not get more Murrow-friendly recordings? We certainly didn't get the annual volumes of I Can Hear It Now, the editors originally thought of, nor did we get the 5 days of Munich or the 24 hours of D-Day or the first 90 days of the New Deal. While all of the group I've mentioned are invaluable historical records, it's unfortunate that the magic of Ed Murrow, assisted by Fred Friendly, couldn't have produced more. However, the few spoken word recordings put out by this team are some of the finest, if not the finest, examples of the use of history to preserve for future generations the sounds of our time.
That's a very good segue into what we are about to do next, because there was another recording, and this is one we've alluded to before, and this is just the excerpts. This isn't the precious master of this unreleased recording, and Marty Werber will now speak to that particular recording.
Okay, just for the record, let me correct one minor point, something that Mike had said earlier.
Okay, fine. I'm not perfect.
Close. I'm the manager of the CBS News Audio Archives. Unfortunately, there is no CBS Radio Archives.
I meant to put the word news.
Okay, there's a big difference.
Yeah, I know.
The idea for presenting the tape you're going to hear now came out of a phone conversation I had with Mike Beale a few weeks ago, when he told me that the with the then availability of Ed Bliss, this panel would be talking about the Murrow recordings. And I casually mentioned the fourth unpublished Hear It Now album. And he said, what do you mean unpublished? There's the Churchill album, which is number four. I said, no, the other album. And I guess it's the danger of someone working with material all the time, that you see it around and you just assume that everyone knows that something exists. I've used that tape over and over again over the years. Producers at CBS have referred back to it, have taken actuality out of it and used it in other shows over the years, just as they've done with the other three Hear It Now albums. And it then dawned on me that very few people outside of CBS were aware of the fact that there had been a fourth in this series. I thought that it might be of interest to the ARSC membership to hear at least an excerpt of it. The record covers the time period 1949 to 1956 with one slight little lapse. The album begins and ends with the sound of Sputnik. And obviously, this was really pressing on the minds of the American people at the time, and certainly on Murrow and Fred Friendly. And it serves as the bookends of the album. The decision to hold the record off the market was Friendly's, apparently. Friendly has always said that you get judged not only by what you put on the air, but also by what you don't put on the air, what you release and what you don't release. And with this album, he felt that they had not reached the standard that had been established with the previous albums, and they held it off the market. Over the years, he had reconsidered that decision as recently as 4 years ago, but at that time he felt that the events were too remote to most of the people who would be listening to the record today, with unless an additional narration, additional editing would be done to the album. When I told him that I was interested in playing this, I was quite surprised. Usually when you try to get permission on these kind of things, there's a great deal of hesitation, but to my surprise, he was quite anxious that the membership of ARSC hear this record, and he would like to get the opinions of the membership as to whether he did make the right decision. It's something that he has thought about over the years. And it's something that the Murrow Estate has thought about also over the years. I spoke to the executor of the estate, and he said that it's something they had been considering also. Part of the problem that Friendly felt there was with this record was that when they did the first volume, which was 1933 to 45, they were dealing with a paucity of material. Actually, we have more material available today of that time period than what Murrow had at the time. They just didn't have the sources. They didn't know where to go for the material. They had a great deal of difficulty locating what they did use. When it came to the 50s, they had so much material to choose from that when they tried to boil it down to a 55-minute package, they felt that the product was just too uneven and that they had left out too much. It had been too subjective, and they just felt that it wouldn't hold up. I think part of it was also a question of perspective. I think that had they been working at a graded time lapse from the from when they assembled the collection, that there would have been a greater selection, a greater selectivity in terms of what they did use and what they didn't use. Let me just add that Friendly did go on to produce I'm sure a lot of you know, I can hear it now, the 60s with Walter Cronkite. And in this collection, they used three records to cover the 60s. And I think most people will agree that they did he did a beautiful job on that. The fourth album exhibits a greater deal of editing than any of the previous records in the series. But compared to the quality of the 60s albums, it seems very awkward, and a lot of the editing is very obvious. The quality is also uneven in terms of length and material. There is a section in the album dealing with the McCarthy hearings, which Murrow was very much involved with. And this really dominates the album. There is one cut in this record, runs 11 and a half minutes, of the McCarthy hearings, the famous confrontation between Senator McCarthy and Joseph Welch, who was the counsel for the Army. And it really throws the whole album off kilter, because
we're running late. I want to close with a comment. Really, what started out this whole session, that almost we can almost say that the age of the spoken word phonograph record is dead. Now, as I mentioned, there are a couple of companies that specialize in it, but the majors are no longer interested in it. Remember the beautiful series of spoken word albums that Decca used to have? They had a separate spoken word catalog back in the 60s. We don't have that anymore. What we have are cassette tapes. Companies that are making cassettes for library use, not necessarily for use at home. As a matter of fact, one of these catalogs is available in there with a sound sheet inside. There are many of these companies. If you go to some college libraries, such as ours, we've got one wall of records and two lengths of that same type of shelving that are filled with cassettes, 12-inch shelves, little cassettes sitting on their ends on the shelf. The real difference is there's so much material available, spoken word. The information has had such a quantum leap, and the same thing is with the spoken word field, but the expenses are lower because you don't have to press up, let's say, a minimum of 1,000 records like a normal producer would have to. You can make up as many cassette copies as you might think you can sell in the next couple of weeks, the next couple of months. When an order comes in, you stick the master in one side of the high-speed duplicator, you slip a blank in the other side, and now you make your inventory at the time of sale. It takes about 5 minutes and it's done. You don't need to have an inventory of thousands of items that may take 5 or 10 years to sell or may never sell. There are loads of these catalogs. The Center for Cassette Studies has catalog after catalog after catalog in different areas: sociology, history and government, arts and sciences, philosophy, religion, literature. And here's a catalog that I just got in a couple of days ago. No, that's not it. Here it is. Yeah, it's the Source Tape catalog. The material in here is extraordinarily similar to the type of documentaries that we used to get, such as I Can Hear It Now. There's a series here on the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. Eyewitness, the Hindenburg disaster, and other things. And it's not necessarily all broadcast stuff. Thing on Negro baseball, UFOs, grassroots about America, the voices of World War II. Well, that's what I Can Hear It Now Volume 1 started out to be, except here they went out and made new interviews in some of these cases. They used some original recordings. In other cases, they talked to soldiers. And these things are now available. Some of them are expensive. That World War II is $119 for 12 cassettes. But that's 12 hours or so worth of material, whereas you only were getting less than an hour's worth of material on an LP. The whole concept of the spoken word record has changed. Now, Marty made one statement to me on that phone call where he talked about Volume 4. The other change that is being made is towards television. And what started that statement was I said, well, Marty, now that Walter has retired from the daily newscast, when are you going to have him sit down and do the narration for I Can Hear It Now of the 70s? He said, we're not doing it. I had assumed, and I'm sure almost every one of you had assumed, that maybe over the last 3 or 4 years, every now and then, somebody over at CBS Audio, you know, News Audio Archive, or somewhere else in the division, maybe at Columbia Records too, would put a couple of things together, preparing themselves for the end of the decade. They'd make a narration, Cronkite would sit down and narrate it, the album would be put out by the end of 1981. It's not going to happen. As Marty says, there's no impetus in the company to do that now. And that you also said that probably the last thing they're going to do on record is the library of quotations you've put out. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't want to swear to it.
You wouldn't swear to it, but it's because right now they're putting things out on video cassettes. CBS has already done a cassette for the consumers on the hostage crisis. Is that right?
Yeah.
And ABC has done one on the Olympics.
We have three out on the market now.
So you can go out and buy a video cassette. You don't have to buy an hour-long phonograph record. You can buy an hour-long or a two-hour-long video cassette if you got $30 or $40. But for those of us who are oral, A-U-R-A-L type people, it would be nice to see things like Morrow said in the introduction to this radio program, that future generations will see these things televised, but there still is that magic to the sound of an event. So, you know, that's just my little final statement about what's happened to sound of spoken word recordings. Thank you very much.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, we are rather late. If you want to ask a couple of questions, I don't see anybody at the doors. If the panel is willing to answer, we can take those.
No, I was going to say go to the microphone, but okay, yeah,
Why don't you go ahead, Wally?
While he's coming up, I want to say one thing. The date of Harding's death is wrong on that volume. You can hear it now. I would say that to begin with, and I know definitely that is not William Allen White's voice.
Okay.
The Grantland Rice was taken from a radio broadcast from somewhere in the 30s of an All-American football awards dinner, and he was one of the founders of the All-American.
Is that where Bud Greenspan got the Grantland Rice that he uses on the greatest moments of sports?
I don't know that, but that's why I know this source. And the Rudy Valley music on here is not the recording. It's a soundtrack of an early sound newsreel of the Rudy Valley band.
Are you sure? I didn't pull out the
No, because it's got a piano introduction, which they would never have used on a recording, a commercial recording.
Okay, I'm not sure. I thought it was the Victor, but I didn't get time to pull my copy out to listen.
That's super.
Well, mention your name for the tape.
All right, for the tape, Paul Jackson. We were doing some research for NBC for their 50 years broadcast, and they were trying to find a recording of the broadcast, Wrong Way Corrigan, and I was wondering if they had ever contacted you, and did you ever find it?
No, they never contacted me.
Yes,
I have a recording of Wrong Way I have a recording of Wrong Way Corrigan on NBC with Durwood Kirby running out onto the airfield when Wrong Way Corrigan lands in Chicago. He puts on an NBC backpack and you hear him huffing and puffing running out to the runway. And then he spends 15 minutes describing later on that morning a 3-minute parade. And he's got to fill about 12 minutes of time after the parade has gone by for Wrong Way Corrigan. No, they didn't contact me. That would have been great. NBC botched up that 50th anniversary celebration, something awful. Oh, they put a photograph out of their first broadcast in 1926 that includes, in the front row, Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart, who were nobodies in 1926. That wasn't their first broadcast. Any other questions?
Any words in defense of NBC?
No. Thank you very much, Mike.
Actually, I had mentioned you in my talk here about the millions of people watch John's Chancellor every night, and it's your job to tell NBC how many millions did watch John Chancellor every night.
Just a reminder, tonight at 7:30, Richard Burns in room 201, if you're interested in seeing the Packburn equipment. At 8:30, in the room up to your left, my right, where the periodicals are, Edgar Hutto will show his Victor multimedia presentation, and after that,